Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. We begin today with our eyes and ears on a lower Manhattan courtroom. A jury is deliberating right now in the trial of Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, Suleiman Abu Ghaith, accused of helping al-Qaeda recruit and plan attacks just after 9/11. It's a test of the U.S. government's ability to try alleged terrorists in civilian courts, no less here in Lower Manhattan. And lots of eyes and ears are on the case, including those of Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University, and Charles Levinson, Wall Street Journal reporter. Both have been attending the trial and both join us with the caveat that if they hear there is going to be a verdict announced at any minute, they are going to have to drop their phones and run into the courtroom. I know we have Charles. Karen, are you there? Not yet. Charles, thanks very much for making the time, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, before we get into the trial, I actually want to start with this chilling President Obama, not Osama bin Laden, who's dead. Obama, President Obama, at the G7, where he said he's not that worried about Russia, but rather
Russia's actions are a problem. They don't pose the number one national security threat to the United States. I continue to be much more concerned when it comes to our security with the prospect of a nuclear weapon going off in Manhattan.
So, Charles, that turned my head. That turned a lot of people's heads. There he is in Europe talking about Russia and Crimea, and all of a sudden he's referencing a nuclear weapon going off in Manhattan.
I'm not sure what to make of that or what to say about that. But, yeah, it does seem like a bit of an unusual pivot. Obviously it's a major concern to Homeland Security experts. You know, over a long period of time, the fear of weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons being deployed in America. No way of knowing if there's some sort of concrete or specific thing that might have provoked him to raise that issue now.
And, of course, in the hands of terrorists, there's been much written and said over the years about al-Qaeda trying to get its hands on nuclear material to use in that kind of a way. And, of course, the Daily News, by way of illustrating how insensitive it is for the president to envision that scenario out loud, they put this mock-up image of a nuclear explosion over the Empire State Building right on the front page today. So there you go, a little sideshow, it seems, from both this Abu Ghaith trial and the Russia-Crimea situation as articulated by President Obama yesterday. Karen Greenberg from the Fordham Center on Law and Justice is with us now. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I'm curious to get your take on President Obama's statement yesterday where he just threw into the Russia-Crimea discussion this prospect of a nuclear weapon going off in Manhattan, presumably launched by terrorists.
Yeah, my take is that it was going to such extremes so quickly that I didn't really understand why he would want to do that, why he want to ramp up the fear factor. I do think that there's a renewed conversation about the danger of WMDs and nuclear weapons. But to take it to that extreme, you know, New York just doesn't need to be, or the United States for that matter, any more scared than we have been. The point is to move on from this moment.
And so let's move on to the trial of Suleiman Abu Ghaith, accused of helping to recruit for al-Qaeda after 9/11. And Charles, here's what I think we know to be true. Abu Ghaith is Osama bin Laden's son-in-law. After 9/11, he gave anti-American speeches and posted videos on YouTube. No one's disputing that this guy supports al-Qaeda and hates the U.S., right?
No, no one's disputing that. What they're disputing is just how integral a member of Al-Qaeda he was, whether he was actually a member or just somebody who was helping them out, whether he knew about operations Al-Qaeda had planned ahead of time, whether he knew about attacks against the United States beforehand, and just how senior and how key a figure in the movement he actually was.
The assistant U.S. attorney said in a statement after closing arguments that Sulaiman Abu Ghaith made a pledge to support bin Laden, and he followed through with pride and without hesitation. But, Karen, how does that translate to breaking an actual law?
Well, can I go back to something that Charles said or that you said
sure.
at the very beginning, that he's not, that there's no dispute about him hating Al-Qaeda? Actually, there is a dispute.
Supporting
about,
Al-Qaeda.
I mean, him hating the United States and supporting Al-Qaeda. There is a dispute about what he thought about the United States, and one of the things that's been entered into the record repeatedly by the defense is that he had known Americans when they were in his homeland of Kuwait, that he had not had any problems with them, that it wasn't about hating America, that it was about understanding how and trying to spread the message how Muslims had been oppressed, and it was America, the West, Christians, Jews. But they've tried to back away from this notion of hating America. So, okay. Now, in terms of how it translates into the legal dimension of this case, I mean, it's actually a very interesting case in this regard. He is charged with material support, conspiracy to material support, and by material support, they mean providing himself in the terms of personnel that spread a message, spread propaganda. And he is also charged with a more serious crime, and that is conspiracy to kill Americans. So the issue of what he actually thought about Americans is actually pivotal to that third charge.
And Karen, prosecutors have cited a collection of video speeches by Abu Ghaith in which he praised the September 11th attacks and repeatedly warned of more attacks, correct?
In which he told Muslims basically to stay out of high buildings and off of planes. I mean, that's the phrase that keeps being repeated. But the issue here is, I think one of the issues here for the jury is going to be, was it a specific attack? Was it any attack? And so therefore, one of the narratives that the prosecution has tried to bring into the case is, was he involved with and did he know about the shoe bomb plot of Richard Reed and others who had other shoe bombs that they were trying to plant and had been deployed to plant in the United States? And so that's also at issue here. And so
the prosecutor said that, quote, Al-Qaeda cannot replenish its stores of suicide terrorists unless it has authority figures like this man. Without people like him, Al-Qaeda dies with every suicide attack. And in response, Abu Ghaith's lawyer told the jury that by acquitting, they could, quote, send a message to those people who think that justice is impossible for a man sitting here in this courtroom, and send a message that it takes more than calling someone a terrorist to produce a conviction. So, Charles, is that what's at stake here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of captures the sort of unusual sort of nature of Abu Ghaith's case, in that on one hand, you know, as the prosecution said in their closing arguments, this man literally was the face of Al-Qaeda in the weeks and months after 9/11. And, you know, the day after, there he was on the video speaking for Al-Qaeda. I mean, he was, you know, the face of Al-Qaeda. And yet, on the other hand, this was a guy who, you know, came to Afghanistan just 2-3 months before 9/11, didn't know bin Laden, didn't really know Al-Qaeda, you know, came to see what Muslim rule in under the Taliban was all about, and sort of stumbled into Al-Qaeda's fold because bin Laden tapped him. He wanted another person from the Gulf to represent Al-Qaeda, to be a face of Al-Qaeda, to help recruit people from the Gulf. He had heard about his sermons, and suddenly he was sort of tapped to be this face of Al-Qaeda, but he wasn't in the room. He doesn't appear to have been at the meetings. He doesn't appear to have been, you know, again, he'd only known bin Laden 3 months when 9/11 happened. So this idea that he was anything, you know, more than, a talking head, basically, for the movement is, you know, seems hard to swallow, I think.
Listeners, any questions for our two guests or any thoughts of your own? Our news department has been covering the Abu Ghaith trial pretty closely as it's been going on. Now it's in the hands of a jury, and so a verdict could come any time from Lower Manhattan. What do you want to say? What do you want to ask? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9673. 9-2. And let's go. Oh, by the way, to clarify for a minute the context of what President Obama said about Manhattan and nuclear weapons. Few people have called in on this and said, no, wait, it wasn't Obama who was out of context. It was the person who asked him a question about Russia, because at the G7, he was at a kind of side exercise about nuclear weapons, which was on the agenda. So the question he got at that moment about Russia was in a way out of context for the moment, and he was speaking within the context of the moment to reference nuclear weapons at all. But there you go. Still suddenly talking about nuclear material around the world in general and denuclearization after the Cold War. Suddenly there was a reference to a potential terrorist attack with nukes on Manhattan. So just to clarify and give everybody a little more context on that. But Karen, Abu Ghaith took the witness stand last week himself to testify in his own behalf. And many observers have said he didn't do himself any favors. He basically bragged about how bin Laden wanted to talk to him the very day after the 9/11 attacks. Did you see that testimony firsthand?
I did.
What was it like?
I mean, I disagree with people who say that it didn't do him any favors. I think it did not hurt him. If anything, it may have helped him because it brought an immediacy to the case. He was very not angry. He was quiet. He's got a very calm demeanor throughout this entire process. And I think hearing from him is just satisfying to the jury. I can't say that it made them feel for him, but it did bring something to the case other than people who had known him only at a distance, if at all, who had been other convicted terrorists and others who had been brought to the stand. So I think it brought a sense of immediacy, a sense that there was a person in the room. One thing to remember about this trial is that as much as it's about Abu Ghaith, it is also a symbolic trial, because still to this day the United States is debating the issue between whether or not for terrorists like this who have been in bin Laden's circle, who are part of the Al-Qaeda network, should be tried in federal court or should be tried in military commissions. And so challenges like this, one of the challenges is, can you put a terrorist suspect of that level or accused of being at that level on the stand? And that's been one of the chief arguments against having military commissions, that it'll be a circus, that they'll use it to grandstand. One thing the judge has been very good at is controlling any kind of grandstanding in the court. And when Abu Ghaith did start to go off on a little bit on the ideology of Al-Qaeda, the judge stopped him. He said, answer the question asked, and it hadn't been the question asked. So I think it was important not just for this specific trial, but had tremendous significance for the larger debate that is going on at the highest levels of our government.
Charles Levinson, Wall Street Journal reporter covering the trial. Same question, and I think Karen meant to say that was one of people's arguments for military tribunals as opposed to civilian court, that in civilian court people could use the trials as platforms for their pro-Al-Qaeda ideology in a way that they couldn't if the military was presiding. Did it give Abu Ghaith a high-profile platform to spread his message? What do you think the lesson learned from the testimony is in that respect?
I don't think the takeaway from his testimony is that he used it to sort of fulminate or used it as a platform to propagate his ideology. My takeaway from his testimony was that, as Karen said, you know, his presence and demeanor in the courtroom was very different than the sort of bombastic firebrand we saw in these videos. He was calm. He was stoic. He was very, you know, together and well-spoken. You know, the picture he portrayed was far more nuanced, I think, than the, you know, evil black and white Al-Qaeda, you know, Al-Qaeda as a sort of embodiment of all evil picture that we have. He spoke, you know, he as Karen said, he has had very positive interactions with the Americans in the past. He made that clear. He spoke very candidly about things that he had no need to speak candidly about that hadn't come out in the trial but could hurt him. So I think he came across as relatively, you know, straight speaking in his testimony, which, again, if you know, I could see conceivably could help him with a jury if they perceived him as I think some observers in the galley did, as sort of speaking candidly and honestly. But I don't think, and you know, in conclusion, I don't think it came away as a you know, platform for demagoguery or anything like that.
Mary in Rockville Center, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I want to know, do these reporters know anything about the religions of the jury? Are they Christians, Jews, Muslims, atheists? Do we know anything about this? And just this comment, this last person said he came across as very whatever. Just because he comes across in a certain way doesn't mean that what he's saying is the truth. And I think an awful lot of what these people say needs to be taken with a grain of salt.
Bernie Madoff used to come off in a very respectable-seeming way to people until they knew what he was about. Charles, on her point about the jury makeup, must be incredibly difficult to select a jury for a case like this. How did they do it, and did they take religion into account?
They passed out a lengthy questionnaire about, how potential jurors felt about the Guantanamo Bay detention facility, how they felt about various aspects of the American War on Terrorism, how they, things like that. And I don't believe religion was brought into it at all. Karen, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, and they have, in prior terrorism trials, they have asked, do you have specific feelings about the Muslim religion? Do you have, but they stayed away from it, and we don't know, to the call-in question, we don't know the religion of the jury. And let's remember also that this is an anonymous jury, which means that their names are not known, their professions are only vaguely known because they don't want to be able to identify them. So that's another factor.
And do either of you know how they chose the jury, what kinds of screening questions they asked, and what kinds of people they used their exclusions on and things like that?
A lot of the exclusions were logistical exclusions, and Charles, you can chime in, but a lot of them were just logistical. Some of them had to do with people who said there was, they didn't support this court process, they didn't support the trial. For the most part, it was very much pro forma and what you see in other kind of jury selection. Jury selection went rather rapidly. They didn't question people intensely on their on really anything, including their beliefs, and they picked the jury the way they normally pick juries. It was a very by-the-book jury selection.
The one exclusion I think that stood out was there's one gentleman who said that he felt like this trial would help Obama, and he couldn't a guilty conviction would help Obama, and he didn't want to do anything that might help President Obama. So they excluded him with a sort of wry, sarcastic comment by the judge.
Yeah, out of here. So Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University, is with us. Charles Levinson, Wall Street Journal reporter, is with us. Both have been attending the Sulaiman Abu Ghaith trial in Lower Manhattan. And Rita in Manhattan. Rita, you have seen trials both at Guantanamo Bay and this one?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call,
Thank
Brian.
You.
I am what is called a family member. That means that a relative of mine died on September 11th.
I'm sorry.
And through a lottery, I was able to go to Gitmo last June to observe the actual pretrial hearings of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the four other defendants. And I want to comment on something that Karen mentioned earlier in this program. The difference between what's going on at Gitmo and what went on in Lower Manhattan is striking. I went into the court in Lower Manhattan, and except for an extra screening before you enter the courtroom, it's open to everybody. Anybody can walk in. Abu Ghaith was sitting next to his lawyers in a suit and a tie without any guards. Just an ordinary defendant. At Gitmo, the five defendants are shackled to the floor, are guarded each by five Marines under secret proceedings and untried proceedings whereas in Manhattan, we have our over 200-year-old judicial system. And I just could not get over the difference.
Karen, do you want to talk to Rita?
Yeah, I mean, I think, thank you for saying that, and I'm so sorry about your loss. It's interesting the other thing about these trials versus the military commissions is that they seem to be able to progress. The military commission system, in addition to the way in which the defendants are treated and the visuals of it, is not able to get to the trials themselves. And I think one of the things that we do not understand as Americans is how important trying the 9/11 terrorist suspects is in terms of getting beyond the 9/11 moment. And so, yes, what's important about this is, yes, the way that the system works here in a way that looks and feels just to the defense, to the prosecution, to the judge, to the public that is watching. But also the very important fact is that the system works. And there's good people, smart people, well-intended people trying to carry out the military commissions, but it's just not working in a way that is efficient and expeditious. So, no, I
don't think it will ever work.
Possible.
Why not, Rita? Why not, Rita?
Well, the arraignment was in May of 2000. I can't remember now whether it's 2011 or 12. I think it was 12. We're still in pre-trial hearings, which means there are motions that will go on for months and months and months, and issues come up each time because it's so onerous for the defense to get anything on the record. So I think by attrition it will stop, and I don't know whether there'll be moved to federal court
in
here
fact,
or not.
In fact, it was May 2012. We just looked up the arraignment to confirm that it's that long that it's all been taking. So, Rita, thank you for sharing your observations. And again,
we're all sorry
for your loss.
Brian, can I add one thing to what she just said?
Sure.
Which is that one of the reasons that the military commissions is stymied right now is that the charges that are being used in this trial against Abu Ghaith, material support charges and conspiracy charges, cannot be used or are on shaky ground, depending on which charge you're talking about, at Guantanamo. And so the plan for going ahead and charging individual terrorism suspects has fallen apart because the courts have ruled that these charges did not exist at the time these people were apprehended and committed their alleged crime. So it's another reason that Guantanamo commissions linger, and that the federal court system on these very charges that cannot be used at Guantanamo can proceed.
As we talk about the trial of Suleiman Abu Ghaith, Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, now in the hands of a jury in Lower Manhattan. And Charles, another concern about holding these sorts of trials in civilian court was the possibility of sensitive information being uttered out loud. At Gitmo, I understand there's a 40-second delay on the feed, and I read that in this trial there was a white noise machine that would mask any conversations about sensitive topics. Is that right, and did they use it?
As my understanding is that the white noise machine was just used when the lawyers and the judge went to sidebar so that the jury couldn't hear what they were discussing. I think for the classified information hearings, they had separate sort of hearings throughout the process to deal with classified information, and those were generally closed to the public and closed to jurors.
One more call. Jack in Brooklyn Heights. Jack, you're on WNYC. Good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Brian. And your show is a testament to how free speech works in this country. My comment to this panel is that, okay, Stanley Cohen, who represented the defendant in this case, he acted zealously. That was his job, and I laud him. However, this man, this lout, should be treated just as Joseph Goebbels would have been treated under the Nazi regime. The entire case is about him fomenting murder and war and raining terror upon the free world. And frankly speaking, Stanley Cohen's message that they should acquit this man to show the rest of the world out there among the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that we're a free country. No, they should send the message that this man should be punished for fomenting war, murder, and terror upon this peaceful city and this peaceful nation.
Jack, thank you for your call. But as to what law he would have actually broken, because it's not framed the way Jack framed it. I mean, that's, you know, the sense that a lot of people have of what he should be charged with or what he should be perceived as being guilty of. But in the eyes of the law, Karen, he's being charged with providing material support to al-Qaeda. So what specifically does that mean, and how did they specifically try to prove it?
Right. He is charged with providing himself as the person who worked for bin Laden and al-Qaeda to spread their message of war and destruction, and he's charged further with therefore being part of the conspiracy to kill Americans. But this caller actually is raising a very interesting point, which is going to plague terrorism trials that are tied to the 9/11 era forever. And that is that, like it or not, this is in a very gray space between war and crime. This country so far has decided that it would like to use the crime model, the criminal justice system, as much as it can to try these terrorists, particularly going forward. And there are always going to be rough calls. In a laws of war court, Tokyo Rose is a good example. Joseph Goebbels is another example that the caller brought in. That would be a different legal standard. What these courts are trying to do is adjudicate where the standards that we think of in terms of free speech get changed by the terrorism context, and that is why they have boosted and bolstered the material support charges over the years so that they can handle this without having to put them in the war context and in the military commission system.
As I said, the jury is currently deliberating. And Karen, you told us off the air that the judge said out loud that he wants a verdict as soon as possible and told the jury that they would stay late tonight if they're needed to. Is he pressuring the jury to be less deliberative than they might otherwise be?
No, I think what he's trying to do, what I said off the air was that he made it clear that they are going to sit and have this verdict come down, but it wasn't a threat. It was more a statement of fact, which is that there's time today, there's time in his schedule, he wants this to happen, he doesn't want this to drag out. And I think one of the reasons he doesn't want it to drag out is what I referred to earlier, which is the symbolic nature of this case. The more it drags out from the perspective of some, the more it seems to think maybe this system can't work. And I think that's what he's trying to do. And he is sending a message to the jury, not that they have to decide quickly, but they have to be as efficient as he has tried to be in running this trial, which he has done. It was originally scheduled for 6 weeks, then it was 3 weeks. When the prosecutor or the defense attorney repeats, he cuts them off. He's done this in prior trials that I've watched. He wants this to happen. So it's more in keeping with that than in any kind of threat or anything like that. But he is going to shepherd this to a conclusion as efficiently and expeditiously as possible.
So, Charles, if the Department of Justice is watching this trial with an eye towards seeing if it means more terrorism cases can be tried in civilian courts, even more here in Manhattan, do you think up until this point, this turns out to be a good choice for a high-profile terror trial in Lower Manhattan to test that premise?
I mean, I think everything has gone smoothly, as smoothly as could be, more or less until now. It's been swift. It's been quick, as Karen pointed out. I think the verdict, you know, I think the jury, well, literally and figuratively, the jury on that will be out until after we get a verdict. And, you know, if Abu Ghaith gets acquitted on both charges, I think, you know, there's a good chance you'll see a real uproar and a real sort of, you know, the real reanimated debate about whether federal courts are best equipped to deal with this. If he gets convicted on both counts, I think it will be seen as an affirmative notch in prosecutors' belts and in the belts of the federal court system. A split verdict in which he gets found guilty of, say, the material support charges and gets 15 years, but gets acquitted of the more serious conspiracy to murder charge. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think what's interesting, I mean, what I've really been struck by is the degree to which these guys, by these guys, I mean the judge, by the prosecutors in the Southern District, kind of have a chip on their shoulder and feel like they have something to prove. I mean, they've sort of taken a beating over the past years, in terms of being told they can't do this, they can't handle these trials, it has to go to military commissions, we're going to give you Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and then we took him away. And they feel like they can do this, and they've shown it time and time again, and still they're dealing with these sort of public criticisms and this public doubt that they're not up to the task. And I think that's what, in Judge Kaplan, sort of, he's going to make sure this jury, comes to a decision, and soon he's not going to let people repeat themselves at trial. He's going to make sure this goes quick and this goes smooth. That all sort of reflects that a bit of that chip on their shoulder.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how shocked would either of you be, 10 being maximum shock, if he is not convicted on both counts? Charles?
I'd be 10.
Karen?
Yeah. I'm somewhere in the 8 to 10 range. I would be very shocked.
We will know soon, as the Suleiman Abu Ghaith trial is in the hands of a jury. We thank Charles Levinson, Wall Street Journal reporter, and Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University, for your depth and your clarity. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.